From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson arrived in Moscow today with a blunt message. Russia is on the wrong side of Syria.
I hope that what the Russian government concludes is that they have aligned themselves with an unreliable partner. Russia has really aligned itself with the Assad regime, the Iranians, and Hezbollah.
That's Tillerson speaking in Italy before he left the G7 meeting. Before he arrived in Moscow, Russian President Vladimir Putin made some comments of his own. He told reporters that Russia wants the UN to investigate last week's chemical attack in Syria, which the U.S. blames on Syria and Russia, and which prompted the U.S. to attack a Syrian airbase with Tomahawk cruise missiles. Michelle Kellerman is NPR's diplomatic correspondent. She's in Washington following all of this. And Michelle, what do you make, first of all, of Tillerson's comments, which come just a day before he meets with the Russian foreign minister?
That's right. Well, he's trying now to do what the Obama administration tried and failed to do. And you know, Jeremy, the Trump administration has really done an about-face on all this. It wasn't very long ago that Tillerson and others were saying the U.S. priority in Syria was to fight ISIS and not Assad.
Right.
They were saying Assad's fate is something that could be put off for a while. And now, as you heard, the message is, you know, Russia, look, Assad's not a reliable partner. He's making the Russians look incompetent because he's using chemical weapons that Syria was supposed to get rid of under a 2013 deal. So it's time to break with them.
And what do you make of what Vladimir Putin had to say today? He wants an investigation into the Syrian chemical attack, but also said this is all set up to blame Russia.
That's right. I mean, he's clearly not buying into this logic. He told reporters today that we should all remember what happened in Iraq, that the U.S. accused Iraq of having weapons of mass destruction and then ended up destroying the country. And he also claimed that his intelligence services believe that there are plans underway to plant more chemicals, possibly near Damascus, to justify more strikes there. So he's trying to discredit Tillerson and the Trump administration.
So kind of a tough relationship here between the two countries as this meeting tomorrow between Tillerson and Sergey Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, is about to take place.
And it feels kind of like Groundhog Day, to be honest. But, you know, it's worth going back to that 2013 deal to rid Syria of its chemical weapons stockpile, its declared chemical weapons stockpile. At the time, it was Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov, and they came away with totally different narratives. You know, the U.S. saw it as a sign that Russia is willing to put pressure on Assad when needed, and the Russians saw it as a sign that the U.S. Was finally recognizing that if you want to get something done in Syria, you have to work with the Assad government.
Let's talk about Rex Tillerson, because he's someone who knows Russia from his days as CEO of ExxonMobil. He's done business there. He was even given the Russian Order of Friendship Award in 2013. How does he fit in as we prepare for these talks?
It's a big test for him because, you know, he's used to coming to Moscow with a lot of leverage. The Russians were interested in doing deals about that. This time, it doesn't look like there's a whole lot to work with. And, you know, we have to remember that the idea originally was we come into this meeting with a plan to work with Russia to fight ISIS in Syria and to push the other issues aside. But now all these other issues are creeping up. Tillerson also had to apparently call the Ukrainian president's office to assure them that there's not going to be kind of a package deal that, you know, we'll look the other way on Ukraine if Russia cooperates on Syria. That's off the table. So no sort of grand bargain here.
But you're saying that he had more leverage as the CEO of ExxonMobil visiting Russia than he does as the Secretary of State?
Well, certainly he had something they were interested in. And this time around, this is going to be a huge diplomatic test for him.
Hmm. Let's listen to one more clip from Tillerson speaking in Italy today.
It's clear to all of us that the reign of the Assad family is coming to an end. But the question of how that ends and the transition itself could be very important to the stability inside of a unified Syria and its stability and durability of the outcome going forward.
Michelle, are we learning anything more about what the administration actually wants to do about Assad? Because we are hearing comments like that, but also some comments that make it sound like they are going to leave it up to the Syrian people.
Well, you know, the UN Special Envoy has been struggling for years to get these negotiations underway to get a transitional government for Syria. And Stephane de Mistura, the envoy, is in Washington making the rounds. And that's going to be part of this discussion. Opposition negotiators are hoping that the U.S. missile strikes will give them a boost and a little bit more leverage with the Assad regime.
That's NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman in Washington. Michelle, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, California is moving to become the first sanctuary state with a bill that would prohibit local law enforcement from becoming involved in immigration violations. More than 150 cities and counties already have this firewall between local police and federal immigration officials. Most say it's so that they can remain trusted in the immigrant community. But about three dozen agencies in 16 states are currently participating in a program in which federal agents train local deputies to identify and detain people who may be in the U.S. illegally. And the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office has requested permission to be the first law enforcement agency in Wisconsin to participate. As Marty Michelson of Here and Now contributor WUWM reports, this is causing controversy.
It could take a year for the Office of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, to approve a partnership with Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark. If it does, one place deputies might be able to detain people is in the county courthouse. Thousands of people pass through a metal detector at the main entrance each day. I'm standing near the electronic device with County Supervisor Marina Dmitrievich. She says there are many reasons unauthorized immigrants might need to conduct business at the courthouse.
Whether it's deeds for their house, marriage license, and mostly court cases, they're interfacing with our security and essentially the Sheriff's Department.
Dmitrievich says while the sheriff initially wants permission to check immigration status among people in the county jail, she fears deputies would eventually detain people elsewhere, at the courthouse or even during traffic stops on the freeway. She says since President Trump announced a crackdown on unauthorized people, there's been a lot of fear among the county's immigrant residents.
They're afraid to take their children to school. They're afraid to drive at night, and they're afraid to participate in society. And if that happens, that actually makes our community less safe.
Many are concerned they'll be rounded up and deported, so Dmitrievich sponsored a resolution that the county board passed in February. It states that Milwaukee County remains a place where unauthorized immigrants are welcome. The move came after Sheriff Clark applied to participate in the ICE program, noting he's troubled by the number of jail inmates who are found to be here illegally. Clark told Fox News' Sean Hannity he's mostly concerned about the jail, even though his application also expresses interest in nabbing people at other locations.
We're talking about, in my case, criminal illegal aliens. We are not talking about doing home raids and business raids to look for people in the country illegally. We are going to identify people who've been convicted of serious crimes in this country and schedule them for deportation. That's not extreme. That's reasonable. And anybody who is not for that is advocating for criminal behavior.
Mark Christopher is a Milwaukee immigration attorney. He says many immigrants are calling his office, fearing they'll be arrested and deported. Christopher says he doesn't believe that a widespread roundup will happen.
It would be very unlikely that the sheriff would be enlisted by ICE to go out and knock on doors, to go out and set up any checkpoints.
But what is likely, he says, is that people will be screened for their immigration status when they are detained in the county jail and reported to ICE if they are not in the country legally. Christopher says immigrants must take every precaution to avoid winding up in jail.
Don't drive without a license. Don't drive an automobile while intoxicated. Maybe they get a ticket or a fine, and they don't pay the fine. Then they'll have a warrant for them for not paying, $100, $200 fine.
If someone has broken federal law and intentionally come to our country without permission from our country, that is a legal concern. That is an issue.
And so, County Supervisor Deanna Alexander supports Sheriff Clark's request to aid ICE, but she doesn't envision deputies will detain people off the streets or from their homes.
So, I think that the reason that this is a controversial decision is because of what people are afraid may happen. I don't think that it would reach quite that level, but I do think that the sheriff should have the authority to comply with the federal government in following federal policy.
Meanwhile, Milwaukee County Supervisor Marina Dmitrievich says she's working on a plan to make the courthouse a sanctuary of sorts.
We've requested in my resolution the anti-discrimination piece that the courthouse be named a sensitive location so that people who are seeking justice would not interact with any kind of federal ICE or Homeland Security agent.
Dmitrievich says if the feds grant permission for Sheriff Clark to participate in the ICE program, she may pursue legal avenues to ensure that the courthouse doesn't become a raiding ground. For Here and Now, I'm Marty Michelson in Milwaukee.
Josh, have a look.
You're fine. I'm looking at this.
Oh,
I recently took the 17-year-old nephew on the quintessential Southern California road trip. We stayed at the retro surf haunt, the Hotel California in Santa Monica, rented a Mustang convertible, and then drove up the coast listening to the Eagle song.
Welcome to the Hotel California.
Oh, and then we met up with a real eagle.
I don't know. Scott? Oh, he's right there.
Timothy B. Schmidt, the Eagles' bassist and vocalist.
Hi.
What a pleasure.
Great to meet
you. What a pleasure
Thanks.
To meet you.
Well,
this is...
Go to the right.
He has the same boyish look, the same long hair, just grayer, than when he joined the Eagles in 1977, replacing Randy Meisner. Before that, he replaced Meisner in the band some of us liked even better, Poco.
And it's a good feeling to know.
Wow.
What? This is insane.
Yeah, this is where I make all my stuff, do all my stuff.
We met up at his beautiful home recording studio, where, in shock after the death of Eagle Glenn Frey this past January, he recorded a new solo CD. His home is tucked high in the Santa Monica Mountains. We'll post pictures at hereandnow.org. In the studio, his collection of Native American artifacts, his Kennedy Center Honors Medallion, pictures with President Obama, and the band he played with as a kid growing up in Sacramento. There are instruments everywhere. A storage room is filled with guitars, including one that was a gift from Glenn Frey when Timothy first joined the band. The little note that was tucked inside is now framed on the wall.
I always saved it because it was cool. And we had nicknames for each other, and one of his nicknames was Roach. And they used to call me Woodstock because of my hair and the beads and moccasins and stuff. After Glenn passed, I got it and had it framed. And it says, Woodstock, happy early birthday, Roach. And it's dated 10/21/77.
Somebody's gonna hurt someone before the night is through.
3 years later, the Eagles broke up for 14 years, then reunited in 1994 and became one of the best-selling bands of all time, 150 million albums sold. Their often volatile story is told in the documentary History of the Eagles.
I think probably the friction was part of the creativity. I'm sure it was.
I was standing all alone against the world outside. You were searching for a place to hide.
Who were you? Who was Timothy B. Schmidt in the band?
Oh, you know, I was the guy, you know, to just trying to make things okay. I did what I can to keep the peace. Sometimes there's not much you can do with the other outside situations, and you just have to go with it.
There's a song on your new CD about that kind of thinking. I can't fix you or can't tell you.
I refuse, yeah. Yeah.
Lose if you're willing to stand tall. Your life is all you own. I refuse to be part of your downfall. You'll have to go it alone.
How are you doing after the passing of Glenn Frey?
I'm doing really well now. You know, it took a quite a while to process it. Well, I don't know if I'll ever finish processing it, but I'm better now. I mean, you know, life has to go on. All three of us, the Joe and Don and I, are all doing our separate projects right now, and we're just moving on.
I know you were working on many of these songs before that, but I hear it in all those faces, you know, that sense of life being short.
Yeah, that's kind of what this whole thing is. It's about, it's a very personal album, and it's kind of like a diary in a way, and that song specifically is, I just kind of spat it out, you know, and left it.
I have seen a magic carpet. I have taken flight.
Well, how would you characterize where you are? I mean, like, I'm looking at you. I have to tell people, you still have that, you know, boyish look. The hair. Did you ever think of cutting the hair?
I think about it all the time.
Don't.
I feel like I'm really starting to get this thing of songwriting and making records, and I've always been sort of a late bloomer in a lot of aspects in my life. I didn't even write a song until I was backed up against the wall with Poco, who said they wanted somebody who could sing, preferably high, and somebody who was a bass player and somebody who wrote songs, and I said, that's me, and I went home and wrote a song.
And I feel so satisfied when
another of Timothy's Poco songs, Keep On Trying. The songs on his new solo CD, Leap of Faith, have the benefit of decades of wisdom.
It's just life stuff, you know, things I think about. And there's less time in front of me now than there is behind me. And I do think about my mortality a lot more. It's those age-old questions, and I just try and put them into some kind of song form and hope that it resonates with others.
I hear that in this waltz.
Oh, yeah, well, that I nicknamed that my Woe Is Me song.
It's a large dose of what's real, and I'm longing to sing once again. Why don't you come close to me?
I had some health issues, and I don't really want to get deep into that, but I was kind of wondering what was going to happen. It involved my throat.
Well, can I say, I mean, it was cancer?
Yeah, I had a bout with throat cancer, yeah. Things are looking really good. It chipped away at my voice a bit, and I didn't even know if I was going to be able to talk, let alone sing, and so I started writing that, and woe is me, poor me, you know.
Well, but what a voice. And that you still have it as you battle cancer in your throat. What are the chances? Did you ever think about that? Like, wait a second, I'm the voice, you know, and then you have, possibly you were going to lose it.
Oh, I thought and think about it all the time still. I had another incident where I was hit in the throat too.
The hit in the throat?
I got hit in the throat with a surfboard. And I mean, I was talking like this. Oh. It was very hard. It was like losing something really that I, you know, really was dependent upon and really was like, it was like losing a hand, sort of. Mm-hmm. I met Placido Domingo the day after the Kennedy Awards. And I was like just thrilled beyond belief because he has changed from being a tenor to a baritone. He just said, you know, I'm just going for it. I'm doing it still in a different range. And that's basically what I got to say to him was, yeah, me too. I'm not going up into the stratosphere anymore. If I need those voices, I get other people. That's humbling to me. But I still do have a voice.
Well, you still have a voice, no kidding. In thinking of coming to speak with you, I went down the YouTube rabbit hole. Mm. And there you were on one of the Beach Boys albums singing Caroline No.
Well, the great thing about that was I got to sing with the Beach Boys backing me up. I was, you know, beyond thrilled, you know.
Yeah, but they picked you. I mean, to do Caroline No. Who are you going to hand that to?
Where did your long hair go?
the girl I used to know. How could you lose that happy glow? Caroline, no.
And then I'm listening to the new CD, the song The Island. And now my understanding, that's Al Jardine's children backing you up?
Yeah.
Why should I leave? It's so crystal clear.
This is what I've always wanted. I'm one of the lucky ones who said, gee, I'd love to do this, and I'm able to do that. To this day, I can turn on the radio, and I hear myself on something I sang on. Maybe it was Steely Dan or others.
Toto, Africa?
Yeah.
Can we talk for a second about Poco? There were people who thought it should have been Poco. You know, yeah, the Eagles were so great. But Poco.
Ooh, crazy love. Ah.
Well, I did have those moments. We were touted as being the next big thing by many people, and we had this great live show. And then we would be driving to another college gig, and we would hear Eagles all over the radio all the time. It became really obvious to me why. It all comes down to songs. The same reason that Eagles might be on the radio for a long time. And it all comes down to great radio-friendly, great crafted songs.
I don't know if I'm living a lie.
Timothy B. Schmidt, his lovely new solo CD is Leap of Faith. For more on his upcoming solo tour and the Eagles concerts this summer, yes, they decided to go out, minus one. Go to hereandnow.org.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. And before we get back to the show, I'd like to ask you about you. That's right. At Here and Now, we want to learn more about our listeners with a short survey. It's anonymous, it's easy, and it'll take less than 10 minutes to complete. Just go to wbur.podcastingsurvey.com to complete the survey right now. That's wbur.podcastingsurvey.com. The survey will be very helpful to us, so thanks. It appears the Federal Communications Commission is preparing to roll back net neutrality rules. Under the leadership of the new FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, who held a closed-door meeting last week with telecommunications groups about the issue, he's meeting today with an industry group that wants to preserve net neutrality protections. For more, let's bring in our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Tony Rahm is senior editor of policy and politics at Recode. He joins us by Skype. Hi, Tony.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And first, why don't you just explain the net neutrality rules as they stand right now? They were some of the Obama administration's signature regulatory changes.
Yeah, this was the big accomplishment of the Obama administration. Net neutrality is this idea that all internet traffic should be treated equally, that an internet provider like Comcast or AT&T or Verizon can't slow down access to other web pages, it can't block or degrade your ability to look at video, whether it's from their competitors or for another company entirely. And the Obama administration really believed that strong net neutrality rules were the only ways to keep the internet free and open, that you really had to use, you know, the toughest portions of federal law to protect the internet from telecom companies. Now, ultimately, telecom companies didn't agree. Republicans definitely felt that the Obama administration didn't need to put such rules into place. And that kind of leads to the battle that we're seeing now with new FCC chairman Ajit Pai looking to put in place his own net neutrality rules that replace what the Obama administration did.
And what would those rules be?
So we have to rewind the clock a little bit back to the Democratic administration to see the comparison, right? So under President Barack Obama, the FCC essentially started treating internet service providers with utility-like regulation. It was very strong rules under a wonky part of law called Title II that many in the telecom industry felt went far against the agency's mandate under law. Now, at the time, Pai, who was a commissioner, voted against those rules, believing that they were a bad solution for a problem that didn't exist. exist. So the draft plan that Pai has put forward would essentially allow telecom companies like an AT&T or Verizon to commit on a voluntary basis not to degrade your internet connection, not to prevent you from viewing web pages or other services. And if those companies voluntarily said that they were going to protect your net neutrality, but then didn't do so in the end, another agency, the Federal Trade Commission, could then slap them with penalties for deceiving consumers. So it's a very, very big difference.
And is this a done deal, or how soon could these changes happen?
Oh, it's far from a done deal. There are lots of moving pieces here. For one thing, Pai hasn't put anything on paper. So the very ideas that we're discussing now could change dramatically just in the next few weeks. And tech companies want Pai to change the ideas he's put forth dramatically. And some of those companies like Facebook and Google and Twitter, through their main lobbying organization in Washington, plan to tell Pai this during a meeting in Washington just in the next couple days. That being said, they have to go through a vote. The FCC has to go through this long rulemaking process. And meanwhile, there's a whole court decision right now that we're waiting for related to what the Obama administration did on net neutrality. So we're really only at the beginning stages of this debate. And I think you can expect it to see, it only gain steam and to potentially bring in internet users who, the last time this came about, were very vocal in their support for net neutrality.
That's Tony Rahm, who is a senior editor of policy and politics at Recode and one of the few people who can make net neutrality understandable to us in the masses. Thanks, Tony.
Thanks for having me.
You know the story. Last year, the Chicago Cubs won their first World Series in 108 years. Last night at Wrigley Field, fans probably raised a few toasts as the team raised a banner.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, your Chicago Cubs will raise the 2016 World Series championship banner.
And one of the biggest Cubby fans is here from the studios of WBEZ, Scott Simon, host of NPR's Weekend Edition. He even had an uncle, Charlie Grimm, who was a Cub player and then manager back in the day. Another mentor was a longtime announcer. And Scott has now written the book, My Cubs, A Love Story. And Scott, listeners know how much you love your late mom, your wife and daughters. That you would call this a love story, too, says something. It says something.
Well, right next to my mother, it's the longest-lasting love story of my life. I think, as I say in the book, if you prick me, I will bleed Cubby blue.
Yes. You talk about how in your head as a kid you were a player. You'd practice throwing acorns between slats of green wooden benches in front of bus stops. You know, you played
with
your
friends. Yes, I was Fergie Jenkins when I did that. I was imitating Fergie Jenkins.
Yeah.
Almost every physical movement I had in life was dictated by how one Chicago Cub or another moved. In grammar school and later in high school on the north side of Chicago, in good weather when the windows are open, you would hear the crowd response from Wrigley Field. Mm. If there was one of the infrequent home runs hit by a Chicago Cub, you could hear the home run cheer from the field. Or when there was a particularly humiliating play, you could actually hear 40,000 people in the middle of the day going, oh. And then I would hop on the L with my friends, and in about the 15 minutes we got to the Addison Street station, the W for win or L for lose flag would be out in front of the Addison Street entrance at Wrigley Field, and that's how we knew if the Cubs won or lost.
Yeah. Well, so we picture little Scott Simon with a voice in his head that says, the big right-hander needs a few batters to find his rhythm, then he'll be untouchable. This story's going on in your head all the time, but you have a great source for that voice in your head.
Oh, and that voice was my Uncle Jack. He was my godfather, Jack Brickhouse, who was the longtime Chicago Cubs announcer, most famous for, forgive me for doing this now, "That's it! Back! Hey! Everybody up on their feet all the way out to Waveland Avenue! Hey!
That's a fly ball, beat the left, back! That's it! Hey! He did it! Ernie Banks got number 500! Everybody on your feet, this is it! Whee!"
And I must say, my father died when I was 16, and Uncle Jack, who'd always been close to my father's best friend through some very tough years with my father and his drinking problem, mm-hmm. losing job after job, mm-hmm. He never lost the affection and regard and esteem of Uncle Jack, who tried to look out for him. And I must say, when my father died, Uncle Jack really stepped in to try and be a father figure to me. Norman Rockwell's painting, The Dugout. That's my Uncle Charlie, Charlie Grimm, who was married to my Aunt Marion, who was in the middle of the portrait, looking, as he used to complain, like a basset hound. that was the cover of the Saturday Evening Post, and that image is what fixed the Chicago Cubs as national losers for the decades that followed.
Everybody in the picture, it was the bench and the coach and the people behind them in the stands, everybody was just horrified,
And the art to the picture is you don't know what the hell has happened on the field to make everybody cringe, so you can fill in the blanks yourself. Look, Uncle Charlie knew he wasn't going to go into the Hall of Fame, so there was something nice about the fact that he was in art museums.
Yeah. And so, you know, you come of this love of this team from all different angles. I want to talk about some of the things I did not know. There was a great controversy about whether or not part of their problem with their long drought, of losing drought, was that they played only day games in the sunshine. This is the beautiful old Wrigley Field.
Yes, but there were many doctors that thought the problem was the Cubs played it in the daytime when they were at home, but they, of course, played at night when they went out of town. And this made their systems irregular, if I might be indelicate about it. And so there was a Prunes for the Bruins campaign begun, where Cub fans were invited to send a sample of their favorite laxative to their favorite Cubs player. You know, a lot of X-lax got unloaded in the locker room for those couple of years.
I love when an entire city gets behind trying to get a team moving again, if you will.
And it just seemed to fit the Cubs' character, I must say. This is part of the, you know, the Cubs, along with the Red Sox, I must say, a totally distinct, unique professional sports franchise. I mean, winning the World Series, they have deprived me of some of my A-list material. I can no longer say, I don't follow professional sports, I'm a Cubs fan. I can't say that anymore, but go ahead, Robin. You've read the book, you probably want to ask a couple of questions, not just hear me go on like this, right?
Well, I do want to play something, if we can, because it just sounds like so much fun. This is 1980.
Ilya?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead, yes.
How'd you know? 1983.
When you say I want to play something, it sounds like so much fun.
And all of the NPR censors are right now quelling.
Oh, boy, they're poised, aren't they? They're in a runner's crouch, ready to hit the red button, aren't they? All right.
This is when the Cubs manager, Lee Ilya, really let the fans have it after the Cubs lost the Dodgers.
The Cubs had lost, I think, 14 in a row or something like that. They came in off the field. Lee Ilya heard some fans booing.
Right.
And when the reporters asked him after the game what he thought, one of my favorite monologues of all time, and I am not forgetting the death of Lady Macbeth speech, okay? Go ahead.
Here it is.
They're really, really behind you around here. What the am I supposed to do? Go out there and let my players get destroyed every day and be quiet about it for the nickel-dime people to show up? The don't even work. That's why they're out at the game. They ought to go out and get a job and find out what it's like to go out there and earn a living.
But Scott Simon, this speaks to the passion. And now there's a World Series championship. You have daughters who really kind of only know a winning Cubs team.
They only know the winning Cubs. They've grown up hearing the story of their mother, my wife, catching me sobbing in the bathroom the night after Stephen Bartman prevented Moises. I mean, sobbing in the bathroom to hope I didn't want my dear wife to know she'd married the kind of man who could cry over a baseball game. But there I was sobbing. She came in. I don't have a chance this year. But to them, the past couple of years, the Cubs have been winners. They don't know the Cubs as losers. For example, when our daughters, we knew they were coming into our lives, one of the first things I would be to run out and get a Cubs onesie. Somehow they would disappear. And my wife would go, I don't know, darling. Well, don't worry about it. I found out later, of course, they wound up at Goodwill because my wife, understandably, didn't want our daughters growing up with the curse and the blight of how you felt as a Cubs fan. But now they have the attitude of winners. Yeah.
Well, but you and other Cubs fans are thinking of those who didn't see this. And I just love this, you know, part of the book where you talk about how people brought their loved ones' ashes to Wrigley Field in baggies or little pill bottles to leave them. And, you know, at the end, you are thinking about your late mom, your late dad, your uncles, you know, the people who didn't get to see this. Or maybe Maybe they did.
Well, I, as a spiritual man myself, I like to think that they did see it. But yes, because it's not just a matter of, gee, my dad never saw the Cubs in the World Series. My grandfather never saw the Cubs in the World Series. I don't know who my great-grandfather was, but he never saw the Cubs in the World Series. That's how long the blight goes on. I have to say, I think of my Uncle Charlie. I was part of a ceremony a number of years ago. Uncle Charlie wanted his ashes to be scattered along the first baseline at Wrigley Field. You know, the Cubs don't like the idea of ashes being scattered over the field. Yeah. I mean, you know, yuck. it's not healthy. Well, my Auntie Marion was a force of nature, and she persisted. So my Auntie Marion got to sprinkle Uncle Charlie's ashes along the first base line, and my Auntie Marion was a lounge singer. So I remember her singing, "I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places," which, of course, first base was to Uncle Charlie. And to this day, if there's a close play at first base and a runner falls down, gets back to the base, we turn to each other in the family and say, "Hey, he gets a pocket full of Uncle Charlie when he gets up." I'm assuming that it's melted into the terroir years ago. And one day I like to think my family will sneak me in there.
Well, That
my family's in the studio right now, and they're smiling at me like I think they hope it happens soon.
Scott Simon, host of NPR's Weekend Edition, his new Little Valentine is My Cubs, A Love Story. Scott, thank you.
Robin, thanks so much, and forgive me. Hey!
Uncle Jack.
Alabama has a new governor today. After more than a year of scandal, Governor Robert Bentley stepped down yesterday. The lieutenant governor, Kay Ivey, has been sworn in to take his place. Bentley has been under fire for allegedly using campaign funds and state resources to hide an affair with his former aide, Rebecca Mason. Andrew Yeager is a reporter with WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama, and joins us now to talk more about this. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's listen first to a little bit of Bentley's resignation speech yesterday.
I've not always made the right choices. I've not always said the right things. Though I've sometimes failed, I've always tried to live up to the high expectations the people place on the person who holds this esteemed office. Though I have committed myself to working to improve the lives of the people of our state, there have been times that I have let you and our people down, and I'm sorry for that.
So, Andrew, let's start with what this scandal was all about. Just remind us, and for people who haven't been paying much attention to Alabama politics.
Sure. This is something that sort of trickled out over the last year. A little more than a year, really, went from rumor to something that splashed across the front pages. About a year ago, the head of the Alabama Law Enforcement Agency, the day after he was fired, came out and said the governor has had an affair and held a blockbuster press conference detailing all the supposed salacious details about this affair between now former Governor Robert Bentley and his top aide, Rebecca Mason. And so that came out shortly thereafter. You had a tape of the governor making sexually charged comments to presumably Rebecca Mason. That was leaked to the press. And from there, it just kind of exploded. So that was sort of the sex aspect of it. But the legal aspect is the allegation is that he used state resources, particularly the law enforcement agency here in Alabama, to go after people, to intimidate people, to try to cover up and hide this this alleged affair.
And he has pleaded guilty to two misdemeanor charges. What are those?
That's right. Yesterday, he pleaded guilty to two misdemeanor charges. They're related to campaign finance violations. So one of them has to do with not properly reporting a loan he made to his campaign. And then the other is deals with money that he used from his campaign account to pay legal fees for Rebecca Mason. Those were the two charges, misdemeanor charges, that he had, or he pleaded guilty to. He actually had been facing potentially felony charges based on complaints last week that were filed with the Alabama Ethics Commission.
And could he still face more serious charges, or is this the end of his legal troubles?
Well, this is the end of his legal troubles, at least as far as state ethics laws go. There are other potential violations that could come up. He also is facing civil suits. There's a wrongful termination lawsuit from both the former head of the Alabama Law Enforcement Agency, another member of his staff. So this does not mean the end for legal troubles, just in terms of state prosecution.
How are people in Alabama feeling about all of this and Bentley's resignation?
Well, overall, I think it's fair to say most people wanted him gone. You talk to lawmakers, they say, particularly over the last few weeks to months, they've been hearing a lot from constituents that they didn't want the governor in office anymore. I was flipping around yesterday to local talk radio stations as Bentley was resigning just to get a sense of what the chatter was like there. And at least from that small sample, you had folks that really felt like he wasn't very sincere. He gave his resignation speech. I heard one commentator say it was more like a retirement speech than an actual resignation speech, that it still was really about him, and he at least publicly hadn't really come to terms with all of the problems that spiraled out from this alleged affair.
And tell us about Kay Ivey, the new governor. What can the state expect from her?
Well, she has been in state politics. She, of course, was before today was the lieutenant governor. She had been the state treasurer before. And in fact, she really is, well, has been a figure in politics for a few years now. She's not generally well known, and particularly where she stands on the issue. The lieutenant governor position is one that's by design is neutral, and so she presides over the legislature without really taking sides one way or another. But talking to people who know her say she is a force for personality. She's not a wallflower. She fills the room, and so she will make her mark on the governor's office, however long she may be in that office.
I did see that Bentley is the fourth governor of Alabama to resign while in office, so it sounds like the people of Alabama are trying to give Illinois a run for its money, my home state, where we've had plenty of governors resign amid scandal.
Exactly, yes. We've had three of the last six governors of Alabama have found themselves on the wrong side of the law in some way, shape, or form.
Andrew Yeager, a reporter with WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama. Andrew, thank you.
Good to be with you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.